It's the Lifetime Body Podcast, where science meets common sense and where we help you make your body last a lifetime. Join physical therapist, author, and human performance expert John Zombro and inquisitive life-optimizing co-host PK the Incomparable as we explore the secrets of food, movement, sleep, ergonomics, and awareness in the pursuit of ultimate wellness. In each and every show, you'll learn how to look, feel, and perform your best so that you can live your longest, healthiest, and happiest life. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode number 23 of the Lifetime Body Podcast. I'm your host, John Zombro, and with me, as always, my partner in not crime, but wellness, and also the maestro de Magnifico, PK the Incomparable.
John Boy, good morning.
And it is indeed that. You know, it was a little slow to get bright and sunny today in southwest Montana, a little cold, a little cloudy, but when you get that winter sun, it's a real pick-me-up.
It's brilliant, yeah, with the blue skies and the snow on the ground. It is hard to beat these sunny days, and you don't even mind the cold, in fact, even if it's in the single digits or teens.
Well, you don't mind the cold because, first of all, you're tough as nails, and second, you're a regular participant in cold thermogenesis.
I am. You know, I think that you've schooled me this past summer, and it's something I keep going, keep doing, regardless of the season.
Well, hey man, like I don't think I school you on anything because you are the man.
Oh, John, you school us all.
In fact, if this was a Van Halen song and my name wasn't John, my name was Dave, you'd say something like, come on, Dave, give me a break. And then I would say, one break coming up.
I love it. Even in your most gentle fantasies, you're the lead singer of Van Halen. I love it. John, what are we talking about today?
This is a great topic today because the title, I think if everyone saw it, Vegans and Carnivores Unite, The Meat Show. So this is a topic that it comes up a lot in conversations with clients and friends alike. You could say it's a hot topic, but our purpose today is to try, as we are two friends talking about health and fitness, and maybe we're many more than two because all of our friends, our listeners are with us as well, but we're going to try to discuss the topic of meat respectfully and intelligently and look at some of the areas of interest and concern regarding meat with a viewpoint that's anything but divisive or incendiary. So what I'm going to say to everyone is kind of welcome. Thanks for being here as always. And join us for the meetup.
The meetup. Well, I am looking forward to this, particularly because of how often it comes up. It seems to come up just in kind of my everyday conversations, just moving about the world. So I'm really interested to learn more about, you know, the different points that you've put together. And just like you said, respectfully and intelligently, start chopping this up, if you will.
Yeah, just some ideas for us all to ponder and not really trying to either A, make this a comprehensive summary of all the literature available, nor make this to feel condemning or that, you know, there's one true right only our way. That's not really the case. So we start off with the idea that meat has been in the ancient and modern diet. It's a big part of it, has been and continues to be. And so that's really why we said vegans and carnivores unite, because they tend to have their division around the topic or the subject of meat.
Yes. Okay. Well, it's a great place to start. Dive in.
So we go back, even though I'm a bit of a dinosaur, I don't go back that far, about 2.5 million years, you know, these humans of various forms, you know, we've been on the earth, and there's been a very interesting interrelationship between humans and meat consumption in recorded history. It seems like every time have evidence that meat was consumed, we had a rapid increase in evolution. You know, whether that was we became more upright or our brain size increased, you know, those things are well studied. But also we interacted with the megafauna quite a bit, and it was the hunting of and consumption of the megafauna, which provided us with the quantities of meat that really led to these advances in human evolution.
Interesting. Megafauna. What is that? I don't know what that is.
A big beast, basically. So you've got, flora is vegetation, fauna is in the animal kingdom. And the large ones like, the mastodon, the mammoth, those types of creatures, which were, historically thought to be very large, very slow moving, not exceedingly intelligent. And so even though they were large, they were somewhat easy to acquire, as a prey species. At least that's what recorded history indicates.
Sure. Okay.
So then we look at what are called nose-to-tail consumption patterns. So, in the ancient and even to some extent the modern diet, we have this nose-to-tail eating, methodology, if you will, where, we humans, because we're animals, we eat most of the lean muscle meat, but also the fatty cuts of meat, the organs, etc. And obviously there will be some folks, today, very modern people say, oh, I don't do any of that anymore. But around the world, we still have quite a few more primitive populations or traditional, shall we say, that are still eating nose to tail.
Gotcha. Okay. And then where do we go from there?
Well, this sort of got supplanted by grain consumption somewhere between 10 and 12,000 years ago. And so the advent of agriculture, the change from hunter-gatherer to agrarian societies, and the ability to feed lots of people easily, maybe not most nutritiously, but easily, that's kind of what grains did. And so we saw a bit of a change in our patterns of meat consumption, and we're still impacted by that today.
Absolutely. And then if we kind of fast forward from there into the current era, what are we, what do you see happening in regard to meat in the current era?
Yeah, I think there's some real issues. There's some stigma, that meat is just somehow bad, evil, that sort of thinking. That's kind of been a modern view that we've developed, that, a meat eater is somehow potentially less evolved, less intelligent, even that, and that's maybe not fair to say or do. And then we've got a number of, very, again, real issues regarding, how meat is produced, the ethical treatment of animals, impacts on the environment. And that's actually throughout all food. You can't make a case that any food in the modern world that's produced doesn't have some impact on the environment. So we obviously think of like these concentrated animal feeding operations, but also when we look at the monoculture of giant fields that have been basically every living creature has been eradicated, but the one that typically is a grain that's being produced. So there are lots of issues that we have swirling around, and I'm not trying to list them all, or certainly offer up solutions to all of them. But some of the problems that we have with research and reporting, I think we've talked about that on the show quite a bit, with respect to how, health, fitness, nutrition, tends to be, a very challenged area for research because of funding and agendas, and also reporting, is much related to marketing dollars. So we have all that. Many of the studies that look at nutrition, and particularly that look at meat, they're based on when they are done in humans, and many of them are rodent studies. They look at dependence upon dietary recall, sometimes going back as far as years and asking a person to recall what they ate and report that. We have another thing called healthy user bias, which also has an inverse. But, essentially, if you say, well, people who eat blank are healthier, a lot of times people who are health conscious or diet conscious are also the same people who exercise, don't smoke, etc. And coming up to the smoking thing, you look at several of the big studies that historically have been, referenced to say, well, red meat causes cancer, for example. First of all, they're contorting the topic of absolute and relative risk. And so, if you go from 3% to 4%, that's technically a 1% change in absolute risk, But in relative risk, you could say it's a 33% increase. And so that's used quite a bit. Well, it turns out that a lot of those data sets didn't control for smoking. And so anytime we say, well, you know, we've got cancer in a population and we didn't control for one of the biggest confounders potentially ever would be smoking, you've got to question the data.
Absolutely. And John, I think the biggest thing that kind of in that last little group of bullet points you mentioned was just about how, depending on where you shake out on either yes, pro meat or against meat, there seems to be such a great divide that's really, that can be really fueled by a lot of contention. And, you know, there is that kind of good and evil, regardless of which side you're on, impregnated into this conversation. And so I think perhaps that's reflective of kind of all of these larger conversations that we're having in our society here in America, just about if you disagree, the person on the other side is your enemy. So I really like, you know, how you set the table here, if you will. Are we going to get down a little bit more? What are we going to shift from now that we kind of understand the sort of the bigger picture and how this all began? What's the next topic that we wanted to hop into?
Yeah. So if we looked at meat as kind of, you indicated there, kind of a, you know, just, it's a global topic, it's a concern, and, you know, there, you know, lots of things are swimming in that sea. Let's talk a little bit about meat on like a nutritional level and mm-hmm. macronutrients such as protein and fat.
Let's do it.
So meat, and again, you know, let me try to be slightly more clear. You know, I'm mainly referring to red meat. Sure. You know, we're looking at some animal products like fish or poultry, and they have nutritional value, but perhaps based on the research, not quite the punch that red meat offers. Well, meat is a bundle, if you will, a naturally formulated bundle of protein and fat, and it contains all the essential amino and fatty acids, vitamins A, D, E, and K are fat-soluble vitamins, and trace minerals that we really require as humans for optimal nutrition.
And that's not on accident. Again, this is millions of years of evolution came together for us to process that as the as that little bundle that works great for us.
Yeah, I think the mastodon hunters figured that out. And so again, I'm not trying to push this, you know, being, you know, overly pro meat. You know, I'm certainly trying to stay open-minded myself and non-condemning in anything that I'm saying. But when we look at how organisms function, you know, kind of being on a scientific basis, organisms figure out ways to get maximum return on investment and conserve energy. And so, you know, early humans, you know, discovered that in order to survive and even thrive, they could acquire these megafauna and, you know, essentially populate the earth.
Yes.
Okay. So then we start looking at some of the really unique things about meat that, you know, many people find fascinating. Let's just use that term. Meat is perhaps the least inflammatory or autoimmune provoking food that exists. And most people would say, are you serious?
What would you say to them?
I mean, yeah, I mean, I am serious. And again, you know, that's the science really supports that, you know, meat tends to be a very well-received and natural food for human animals. And we tend to not have the same problems that we have with, you know, certainly with grains, some nuts and seeds, many plants because of the lectins or the phytates or even just the high carbohydrate content that exists in those foods. And so, you know, whenever a person is going on, you know, an autoimmune diet, like there's an autoimmune paleo protocol that used to be popular, maybe not as much as now, or they're trying to reduce inflammation in their body, they start eliminating foods that are suspect. And there are lists that, you know, we've all probably heard of, but ironically, red meat is often well tolerated by practically every person. Hmm. Not that everyone wants to hear that or believe it, but it is quite true.
Sure. And again, I liked how you put it there, just sort of scientifically speaking, as an organism with no, you know, just looking at the results, you're just saying this is, we're just looking at the reaction between these two different factors.
Yeah, oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's it. I wanted to keep going.
Yeah, I think I'm excited as usual. I love to ramble on and dive deep on these shows. And so, you know, when you look at meat, it's actually been shown to be far superior in our ability to assimilate it as a nutrient, and particularly with those amino acids, than plant proteins of any type. And that's worth knowing. Not to say that a person can't get most of their protein requirements or even all of them from plant sources. It can be done, but it takes quite a bit more work and actually amount of plant proteins to be consumed to match the amount that one would get in a very small portion of meat.
Got it. Interesting.
Yeah, I just read, it was last week, I think, an article came out talking about pea protein, which has gotten popular. You know, we've kind of gone in the vegetable proteins a little bit away from soy, and you know, we've seen hemp protein and pea protein being more popular. But they, you know, have been shown to not be as assimilable as whey or egg protein, for example, but certainly red meat being superior to that. And so then you get into the two questions there is, you know, well, what's the amount that I have to eat to get enough, of absorbable essential amino acids to undergo protein synthesis in my body? Okay, that's a lot more with this pea protein, according to the study. And then also just how much processed powder are we really designed to eat versus that natural bundle we were talking about earlier?
That's a worthy question.
Yeah, and I don't know the answer. My stance, I mess around once in a while with supplements. I like to experiment. But also my gut feeling, if you allow me to say that, is that it doesn't seem natural, for me to take powders versus real food and whole food. So that is a thought that I have. When we talked about nutrient density there for a minute, particularly with respect to protein and fat and fat soluble vitamins, but also there's a crazy effective impact on satiety. So satiety is that feeling that, you know, we're satisfied, we're not hungry anymore, our body has what it needs. There's some actually deep, a deep rooted hormonal relationships to that. Meat, because it contains protein, which is very satiating on many levels, and also fat, some cuts more than others, contributes to satiety magnificently. So not only does it tell our bodies that they're nourished, but it helps people who are trying to, control their body composition because they don't have this chronic overstimulation of appetite.
Yes, indeed.
And so maybe one more, a thought about meat in terms of nutritional biochemistry is very minimal impact on blood glucose levels. The amount of carbohydrate in most meat is negligible. There's a small amount of stored glycogen in some muscle cuts, but for the most part, you're eating fat and protein, you're not eating carbohydrate when you're consuming meat. Consequently, its impact on insulin, we know insulin is probably one of the major drivers, the chronic elevated insulin, of disease and a shortened lifespan. So meat's impact on insulin is less than, let's say, high carbohydrate foods. You notice I didn't say it's non-existent, because that's not true. Protein does raise insulin. We need to use that hormone for, absorption, as well as IGF-1 and some other things. But the work of Dr. Benjamin Bickman down at BYU, he's been prolific lately. He's talked a lot about how protein consumption in particular tends to concomitantly cause the body to secrete glucagon, which is the kind of like the partner or the opposing hormone to insulin, and thus negate any negative effect that some other people might perceive with respect to insulin itself, or even the mTOR pathway.
Absolutely, John. And if you say, I want to talk about, nutrition, my macros, how it affects the biochemistry. I mean, there were, five or six different areas of concern that, regardless of what, if you just had fill in the blank, affects my glucose levels and the inflammatory factors and how it might affect the autoimmune provoking type factors. Again, this isn't my area, so I'm just speaking as a layman. These are things that you want to consider regardless of what whatever type of nutrition that you're putting into your body. So I just think that it's really illustrative to step back and say, this is what the science says that meat does.
Yeah. And for those who are really inclined, I think you have to go to the level of finding the journals, online these days and reading not just the abstracts, but the entire article and make that a hobby if you really want to feel like you're well informed or also read the books and listen to the presentations of some of the thought leaders. It's quite valuable. I'd be a little careful, looking at older doctrine or dogma, and particularly, some of the things that come out in popular magazines and newspapers, they're contorted a bit based on misunderstanding.
Right. Well, John, I just want to let all the listeners know that this week's show is brought to them by the Lifetime Bodies Health and Performance Coaching and Consulting Services. So if you are working on a sports or fitness goal, a body composition project, perhaps you're tweaking your diet to fit your personal wellness needs, or you're trying to make your workstation more ergonomically correct, JZ and TLB can help you. So if you're interested, you can dip on over to thelifetimebody.com today and check out services and look at the menu. And that might be something that would work for you depending on what your goal is. And this raised a thought in me, Jay-Z. Can you tell us about what's coming up next week and beyond as we get close to closing this year out and turning the corner to next?
Absolutely. This is a really fascinating thing for me because I enjoy working with those clients and I have limited availability for it. I'm human. I can't, be more than that. But one of the things that I have noticed and I've tried to incorporate in my work and study is when we are trying to create a program, usually it's a fitness, exercise, training, athletic program, it works better if we not only use all the principles of exercise physiology and advanced training, but we also figure out how to make the program fit the animal or the person best. In other words, make your fitness program fit you. And so that's what I've been working on really for years, but what's coming out, and we'll be talking about quite a bit on the next few episodes of the show, is the new Animal Fit program, which is designed to take the reader through a series of simple tests and observations and actually figure out what their, things like somatotype, which is body type, neurotype, how their neurotransmitters function, and many other things so that they can see where their strengths might lie and also how to leverage that so they have more success with their training. This kind of, I'm not trying to put myself out of business necessarily, but that's really what one of my goals was. Well, instead of having people be dependent upon working with people like me, I still think there's a place for that. Why not give them some tools so that they can get so much further along with their training by understanding, what to do specifically for them?
John, I'd say it's exciting. And I'll just, listeners, I've seen some earlier, not drafts per se, but just we've discussed this, John and I have, and it is exciting stuff. And I'll just say, stay tuned because there's some fun stuff to come and in the near future.
Super. Thank you. And then we're back on meat. And, now let's talk a little bit about, probably what can be, might feel like the most sensitive of things because it's the concept or the subject of meat and vegans.
Meat and vegans. This is a polarizing little world to dip into, John. I'm interested to see how you navigate this.
Yeah, well, I don't know that I'm always the most PC. Here we are, two friends talking about health and fitness with our, couple thousand other friends. Hopefully, like, subscribe, share, and let's see how we go bigger. But I want to clarify that I understand, and I think most of us do, vegans, first of all, to be a true vegan, only consume plant matter and do not eat animal products. So I'm not talking about people that consider themselves you know, lacto-ovo vegetarians. In other words, they eat milk, eggs, cheese, along with their vegetables, or pescatarians who include fish in their diet. Not really talking about those. I'm talking about strict vegans who only eat the plant matter. And, you know, we have to recognize that most people tend to do that for ethical reasons. They really feel strongly about animals and, you know, not wanting to be involved in, you know, the meat industry in any form. And we respect that.
Absolutely. I think that choice is, you know, on the individual level, beyond any sort of judgment or comment from the outside. If that's, you know, if that's the foundation, then that is, you know, like, just like you said, we respect that totally.
Yeah. And so we respect those choices and we respect our fellow men and women, but then we do a bounce back to science and, you know, we'll look that the vegan position is that humans are basically herbivores, you know, designed to eat only plant matter. That's actually one of their points. And that's inconsistent with biology. It's inconsistent with how our you know, digestive, gastrointestinal systems are designed, you know, teeth, jaws, all sorts of things. So we have to be careful not blending things too much. And we want to respect that people make choices and that is their right to do so. But that is not scientifically justified. In other words, that the human is an herbivore, nor has there ever been any, you know, recorded data of a surviving totally vegetarian human population.
Interesting. And I think it's important to, that's an important point that, you know, from a philosophical perspective, there is, you know, there's no alternative argument, but when you look at the science and you just kind of look at the data, it's not supported by how your body processes the nutrients.
Correct. And so many people feel that, let's say they take a vegan journey, they're doing it for their health, you know, as well as those ethical reasons. But, you know, the literature doesn't entirely support that. In other words, if you said, what's the healthiest diet for a human, science is probably going to come out and say it's going to be at least what we might consider balanced in that it can include some animal products. But where this gets confusing for a lot of folks is they'll say, well, you know, I went vegan, I got off my standard American diet and I felt great, at least for a while. And largely that's because we've said this all along. If you want the low hanging fruit, if you will, in nutrition, just stop eating junk and you're going to feel better anyway, no matter what. So, you know, when people start eating large quantities of fruits and vegetables and they've gotten away from, you know, processed foods and all the starches and sugars and flours, well, sure, they're going to feel better, but there are some data to support that may not be a forever situation.
You know, John, interestingly enough, I don't know if you know this, but back, it's been probably about 9 years ago now, I took a path nutritionally that was kind of like a quasi-vegan path. And one of my buddies, Tilero, he said I was a selectitarian. Because I did have a little bit of fish and interestingly enough, just that, what you just described, I did feel a lot better initially. And it was about, you know, maybe 3+ year, kind of arc in my nutritional life. But when I look back, it really was the elimination of the highly negative components of the standard American diet versus what I was choosing to eat rather than what I cut out. So that's really interesting point that I can offer, just, you know, one man on the street's perspective of having lived exactly what you just said.
Yeah, you're the man on the street. I already said that today, but getting rid of the bad is the first step in everything that we should do, you know, right, in life. So a vegan can do well when he or she studies nutritional biochemistry and learns about, you know, things that are deficient in the vegan diet and uses supplementation. And that's particularly true with certain things like vitamin B12, iron, zinc, omega-3 fatty acids. You know, those are things that the vegan diet is deficient in. And so that's where a lot of the money is, if you will, in being successful. And that same as you, you know, I, back in the 80s, you know, back when everything was right, You know, you got to bear with me here. Back in the 80s, I spent about 9 months on a strict vegan diet. I did it for performance goals. Some things I read suggested that maybe I needed to do this. And the results were abysmal in my case. Exhausted, chronic, pale, pasty, weak, all the things that, you know, you'd say that are kind of negative. But I want to be clear, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know back then, and I didn't know as much about supplements. And so I need to be fair. I probably could have been much more successful had I, known that. And, these meals of, salads with no dressing and air popped popcorn and tons of apples. I feel like I lost almost a year of my life there.
You know, but John, I think you just said it, just a couple minutes ago. This, again, if you were just looking at this with no judgment, and all you did was plugging the nutrition into, say, like a macro calculator, just that alone, if you had had that in the 80s, it would have provided you some information to connect. It wouldn't about, being a vegan or not. It would have said, this is the fuel that you're putting into your body, and you could connect it directly with the results, regardless if it was, what sort of umbrella it fit under.
Yeah, and particularly now, what we know about fat, back in those days, that was the peak of, fat was feared, and we were encouraged to have as little of it as possible, whereas now we see it as an essential nutrient, for all of us to some extent. And so, vegans often will report, they feel great, at first, coming off the processed food. And then they're the people that, people that we don't really want in the lifetime body circle are those that want to see others fail. That's not really what we're about. Let's bring everybody up together. But you can read about this. They like to call it failed vegan syndrome. And, it's usually a couple years in when a person who's been a very devout vegan and hasn't been supplementing and getting those other nutrients, begins to have, issues with chronic fatigue and inflammation and other things, which can be rectified quite rapidly by improving the diet. But there's word of that. And then I have a number of people close to me who, they claim to be vegans, and again, I'm not being judgmental, but they are inadvertent or closet Cheegans.
Cheegans, okay.
Yeah, which would, I'm not trying to be snarky here, but, cheap vegan. In other words, they do eat a vegan diet, 5-6 days a week, but then they allow themselves to actually sneak in a piece of meat or fish or whatever. And that's probably enough to offset some of these things. Although, to be clear, that's not being a true vegan. It's maybe a Cheegan. And I've got a funny example, a few years ago, my niece was visiting, and, she was a, teenager and kind of getting to that point where she didn't want to hear anything that I had to say. And I was actually maybe smart enough to realize that and didn't say too much, but we were on a trip, and we'd stopped at a grocery store to get something to eat, and we had a number of kids with us, and so just let everybody get what they wanted. And so some people got some things from the salad bar and this and the other, and the vegan came out with two things from the deli section. One was a package of those deep fried potato logs, which, okay, even if they might be delicious, it's a high carb bomb soaked in vegetable oil. Nobody, that's not good for anybody. So it is, that was a vegan food, but not necessarily a health food. And I didn't say a thing. And then the other thing she had was a large container of mac and cheese with bacon in it. and so I'm noticing, it's like, well, okay, that's a fairly another processed food issue there as well, but it's got cheese and it's got bacon. And so I said, as politely as possible, I said, I thought you were a vegetarian or thought you were a vegan. And she said, well, I am a vegan, but I eat bacon. And I was like,
John, I tell you, that's illustrative. I think maybe even more of human nature than it is anything about vegans or nutritional choices. That's interesting.
Yeah, and so I think we could go on, but let's not do that, and certainly not do it at the expense of vegans and vegetarians. Let's talk about the other side a little bit, because I think the pendulum, certainly in our right now, has swung towards carnivores or carnivory.
Yes, let's get into it. The meat eaters.
Yeah, so we've got a number of people out there who are eating only meat and animal products. And, you know, first of all, we say, well, it does simplify your shopping and cooking. You know, it's when you order, you have one thing or three things. Okay, I get that. And a lot of these folks will cite the similarity, the highest degree of similarity in our gastrointestinal tract design, the pH of our stomachs, length of small versus large intestine, that humans are most similar to dogs, believe it or not. And that, you know, this group would say we really are more true carnivores than certainly herbivores.
So just to clarify, you're talking about folks that just exclusively eat meat. They're not eating vegetables or anything else. Just meat.
Just meat.
Got it. Okay. Carry on.
Well, that we have growing anecdotal support for this, and so I think some research is beginning, but it's going to take some time. But you know, there are people in the thousands. There's some websites and some, you know, people on social media who have they've resolved their health issues on an all meat diet, and it's hard to argue with their success that, you know, they had tried, you know, various elimination diets or autoimmune protocols, and eventually they just got rid of all the fruits and vegetables, plant material of any type, and then their problems went away. So it's powerful.
Interesting.
Now, I would kind of jump in and say, well, you know, trying to be the objective person that I want to be, I'd say, well, you know, those results probably happen for people who probably had quite a few issues and, you know, really had a lot of sensitivities. And so if you have a person who maybe doesn't have those issues, like myself, that the outcome might be different. And I'll talk about that in a second. But a lot of the, you know, the carnivores will say, well, we really need to look at the paucity of convincing data regarding the human's need for fiber, for all these antioxidant polyphenols, high doses of water-soluble vitamins like, you know, the B and C vitamins. That's really quite a strong belief, which we have in health and medicine, but we don't have tons of really hard data to substantiate that we absolutely need it. You know, so the meat eaters are saying, hey, you know, I don't know that you do, and I certainly have done fine. People say, gosh, you know, well, meat's this horrible, you know, stagnant, rotting thing in your gut, and you got to have all this fiber to push it through, and you know, most of the people who are the proponents of this say, well, it's actually the opposite's true. You know, the transit time of this is quite rapid and comfortable and normal. So, you know, some good arguments exist.
You know, and I would, excuse me, I would say that it sounds like it's early in the game for this particular, you know, this particular philosophy, and that they, you know, the research, like you say, is catching up to this kind of modern day strict carnivore nutritional program.
Yeah. And so then we say, well, you know, is it really modern day, or is this the way we've always eaten, at least, you know, for several million years, and should be? And that's up for debate. Of course, I've got some ideas on that, which I want to put forth, but I will say that just like I tried being a vegan back in the 80s, well, this was more recent. I tried being a carnivore. I did it twice. I did a 3-week stint. I didn't think that was long enough, so I did another one for 5 weeks. And this time the outcome was, you know, was kind of more of a baseline where I didn't notice anything. You know, I obviously at this time in life, I'm fortunate to be, you know, having fairly good health and, you know, fitness and those sorts of things. And so I went on an all meat diet where I did not eat any vegetables, fruits, anything, just ate meat products for those times. And I felt the same. I felt good, but I didn't feel necessarily astronomically better than where I was. And so I'm just sharing that, you know, here's my N equals one.
Interesting. So, Okay, so we offered a couple of different perspectives there on the opposite ends of the scope. Where are we going to take this conversation now, John?
Well, let's kind of bounce back into history for a moment and talk about meat and hunting.
Okay.
You know, when we consider grammar and you know how when you have hyphenated words, a lot of times they're in alphabetical order. You know, typically you'll see this. So why aren't we humans called gatherer hunters?
I don't know. Why not?
I'm not so sure either, but I think a lot of the people who research and write about the topic would say that the evidence says that we were hunter-gatherers, or hunters first, gatherers second.
Interesting. Okay. I'd buy that.
You know, or in other words, we were going to preferentially eat meat when we could get it, to just put it that way. And so there's fairly strong anthropological and archaeological research going on right now, such as that done by Mickey Bendor, also hyphenated, last name Bendor. And some of his work, as well as others, was cited quite heavily in the bestseller book I read earlier this year by Yuval Noah Harari, Sapiens. And in Sapiens, really that was the message that came out, was that humans preferentially consumed and ultimately killed off the megafauna. Because, you know, they were easy and so nutrient dense, and that's really, it wasn't necessarily ice ages that wiped out the mastodon, it was us.
Really?
Yeah, really. And it's like, whoa, are you kidding? That's different than what I learned in fifth grade.
That's very different, yeah.
Yeah, went to the Smithsonian, all that. But, you know, what happened then was the need to then be able to hunt smaller, faster, smarter game. To get the life-sustaining fat and protein, it drove humans to you know, expand on physical and cognitive development. So the, at least this is what, again, the experts, who I'm not claiming to be one, would suggest. It's like, well, you know, we were doing pretty well eating these megafauna, but that was kind of easy. And then suddenly, because we still needed to get that nutrient, you know, the bar got raised and we had to adapt.
That's a fascinating theory.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, as I'm a modern hunter. You know, I've been hunting, you know, pretty much all my life, and you know, I view that as it's a primal tradition, and it's one that it should be. I pursue it just as I think all, you know, primitive peoples have, is that, you know, it should be approached spiritually and with reverence toward the animals. But I find that does several things for me. It gives me connection to my ancestral past, but also it, in this modern world, it gives me the opportunity to source high quality meat, of which, you know, I've got some wellness concerns. So, and you know about this, I practice and endorse the field to table journey.
Yes, you do. You spread it around as well, not just your table.
Yeah. And so, you know, obviously when we want to honor the animal, and also we want to have a celebration and share good nutrition with, you know, those around us. And so I'm always, you know, trying to learn, you know, how to, you know, do things differently, better, you know, to butcher and cook and smoke and prepare and share. And I think another meat drop, as we like to call them, is coming your way.
Very nice. You know, my perspective on this in the hunting aspect is that, you know, growing up in Montana, this was kind of part of my, you know, family's culture. Personally, I have hunted. It's not my cup of tea. But I think that, not my cup of tea personally, but looking at this, it makes logical sense to me that just as humans have evolved, and I'm not a scientist by any stretch, but, it seems like, even if you look at kind of the stories or campfire stories, that, you know, the capture or the, you know, the harvesting of an animal was like a celebration, and that was the most sort of valuable piece of nutrition for survival. And I think that I think it's just worth consideration that, you know, it's a valuable source of nutrition, that there's a reason that those stories have existed over the course of time for thousands and millions of years, just about how, you know, the harvesting of an animal was important and valuable, whether it's in, you know, regardless of the actual culture.
Yeah, you know, celebrating nutrition as tradition. You can go back to cave wall paintings. I mean, this is we have evidence of this, and you know, even modern artists, will capture that. And I think there is a spirit that they're trying to capture there. And also, you know, and you were talking about that you yourself aren't a hunter. Well, hey, that's okay, because you know, we had lots of roles and jobs in our tribe. Not everybody had to be a hunter. In fact, that almost gets back into the animal fit thing. Each person has a different skill set. So, you know, if I was, you know, a member of the Lewis and Clark expedition, you know, went through, you know, right here by our homes not too long ago, I probably would have been a hunter. And that's because I've got a skill set that, you know, seems to do well in that arena. But also, you know, I'm not, I don't have your power and your strength. And so you would have been dragging the keelboat up the rapids. I would have been useless at that. And so there were people on the Lewis and Clark expedition who were designated hunters. They paralleled the core of discovery. And basically their job each day was to come back with meat. And this is in the journals Meriwether Lewis had written, each man consumed 10 pounds of meat per man per day provided by those hunters.
Wow. Wow. So that is a lot, but they were doing a lot of work. And, John, I want to take it home. I think I want to, get into sort of like the final conclusionary, like little chunk of stuff. What would you offer to a listener saying, all right, I've absorbed everything. What do I do? Or what are your thoughts? Or how should I proceed?
Yep. In the end, you know, I say this to you, I say it to the listeners, you're awesome. We love you. We're all in this together. So in the end, make your own choices, of course. Let this little discussion just give you some ideas, perhaps. And we just want you to be healthy, first and foremost.
Absolutely. And you know, make your own choices. And there's some information out there. There's perspectives, there's anecdotes to gather, and then kind of proceed as you see best fit.
Yeah. So bringing it home, you know, my perspective in all of this, and I know we covered a lot of material today. You know, I look at history, I look at biology. Well, I see the human, you know, when I think of all those things, as a preferential carnivore first, and as an obligate omnivore second. So what that means is, yeah, I see that it makes some sense to me as I look at the history and the evolutionary biology. When we could get it, we ate meat. And when we couldn't, we found ways to survive on these other foods. And so we evolved eating whatever we had to get between, get from one mammoth kill to the next. But ultimately, probably, and this is conjecture on my part, we probably developed the machinery to extract more sustenance from these plant foods than, let's say, being strictly carnivorous. So in other words, the modern human might actually still have a strong component of carnivory in his or her DNA, but we may actually have the ability to thrive on plant matter at least to some extent, and perhaps more than many carnivores might suggest.
Interesting. Okay. That makes sense to me.
Yeah. And, you know, that's kind of, hey, lifetime body, where science meets common sense. But, you know, the assignment for us all is this. We need to work hard to clean up our food supply. We know we have so many problems with impacts on the environment. And you know, when we eat what, you know, I like to call, you like to call, a planet-based diet, that's P-L-A-N-E-T, as opposed to leaving the E off, you know, a planet-based diet means the food comes from the planet, it's not harmful to the planet, and it's great for humans as well. And so there are ways that can be accomplished, but it's gonna take work. And I think, you know, I don't think that laboratory-created meat is the answer, just throwing that out. But I do think we need to be extremely sensitive to you know, how we care for plants and animals, and how we, you know, control pollution with respect to the impact of those things on the environment. So let's move forward with open minds and respectful hearts, not as vegans or carnivores, but as humans.
Indeed.
So thanks again, listeners. And so this week's review of the week, which is what we do at the end of every show, came in on Apple Podcasts, and it is from DS_20, who has this to say about the show. 5 stars. Wonderful. A podcast for all things health. This is not just opinions on current health topics, but a wealth of applicable information based on current research. Touching on a broad range of health topics, Jay-Z and PK break the information down in a way that anyone can relate and apply to their current training and healthy living pursuits. Whether you are a lifetime health-conscious individual or someone searching for a place to start, this is the perfect supplement to healthy, informed living.
Wow, that is high praise. That is wonderful to hear that impact is happening out there.
So appreciative to you, DS_20. My heart goes out to you, and I mean that. Thank you so much, and thanks, listeners. We've got a lot to live up to there, and we'll do our best. See you next week.
Adios.
Thank you for listening to the Lifetime Body Podcast. If you'd like more information on the Lifetime Body publications and services that can help you to achieve ultimate wellness and look, feel, and perform your best, check out thelifetimebody.com. And if you're digging this content, please leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to the show and share it with your friends and family. Until next time, this is the Lifetime Body, where science meets common sense and where we help you make your body last a lifetime.